is Aiden with Oddball Pilot. I'm sitting down with Mike Singer, also of Oddball Pilot, and John Gowie, who is the chief pilot of Kenmore Air Harbor. We're in Seattle, Washington, where Kenmore Air Harbor is based. Kenmore is, we think Kenmore is the largest scheduled 135 float plane operation in the lower 48, possibly the world. That sounds right, John?
It does sound right. Certainly the lower 48. There may be one company based out of Vancouver that could rival us in size. So I hesitate to say in the whole world, but certainly in the lower 48, I think we could safely say that.
Okay, we'll stick with that. John, like I was saying, John is the chief pilot of Kenmore Air. Mike and I started working with him back in 1993 or so. We were working the line. He was our boss, and we were fueling the planes. At that point, John had just been promoted up from flight instructing to a standard schedule pilot flying the Beavers and Otters. So let's get back to John and kind of how he got into into flying and why he chose Kenmore. So, John, when did you first get interested in flying?
Oh, I had been interested in flying my whole life, ever since I was a kid. And I grew up in Lake Forest Park, which is very close to here. So I used to watch the float planes go overhead, back and forth over the house, and I thought, you know, I would really like to do that someday. So I would come down here as a kid, ride my bike down and wax people's airplanes and get rides, and just loved it. I thought it was great. And I didn't really do anything about it right away. I went to college first and got a degree.
Degree in journalism, right?
Yes.
Yep.
And then I came back and started working for Kenmore in 1990 is when I started. And I worked on the line crew, just like you guys did, which are the guys that fuel the airplanes and service them, take them in and out of the water.
Wash them.
Wash them, that's right. So I did that for one summer, possibly part of a second, I can't quite recall. And then I got all my flight ratings, including my CFI, and I started instructing for the company.
Okay, where did you get your flight ratings at?
I got my private license down in Corvallis, Oregon, but I did all the rest of my training up here in the Seattle area.
But you were in land airplanes that you did that, and then transitioned to float planes.
That's right. And the question always comes up, are you better off doing all that on floats, or are you better off doing that on wheels? And what I always recommend, for most people, it makes more sense to do it on wheels, to get your private license and your commercial license on wheels. It's cheaper, it's generally faster, there's a lot more FBOs to choose from. If you do it on floats, you have more weather issues, you have more cost, and frankly, even if your eventual goal is to be a seaplane pilot, you don't have to do it that way. Most people don't.
Okay, so you're better off getting everything together the cheapest way you can, and then going, getting a float rating and building some float time.
That's right, okay. That's right. I really think it makes sense to get your add-on float plane rating after you have your commercial ticket, okay, rather than adding it onto your private license. You might as well add it onto your commercial license so you're not doing two check rides.
Right, then it's a commercial single engine seat.
Correct. Yeah. I didn't take my own advice there. I got it after the private license just because I was really interested. And in a way, that was okay. I got to build a little bit of float time before I did the commercial add-on, but I took two check rides, which you wouldn't necessarily have to do.
But I imagine it also provided some extra inspiration at that time.
Well, it did, and at the time I was working here on the line crew, and I had access to, at the time, our 172s on floats, and we used to rent those, so that was a way for me to build some float time.
Right.
So it was probably a good thing for me at the time, but it's not something you would have to do.
Right. So you worked the line. Before we move on from that, the line job here, I always found it's one of the more interesting line jobs I've done, partly because you are moving the planes around the forklift, which float operators do, and the washing the planes every night, which
right,
you do religiously with your planes.
But we do. Yep. When they're operated in the salt water, they say about every 7 to 9 years you have to do a complete rebuild on them. You really take them down to the bare skin, pretty much, and you end up reskinning part of the airplane inevitably because of corrosion issues. And we do the best we can to keep the corrosion down. Just like you said, we wash the airplanes every night.
Minimize the rebuild
right
when it comes.
Right.
You also are warm-up planes for the pilots. You'll start them up in the mornings.
We do. The Beavers are the ones that need to be warmed up. They have the 9-cylinder radial, the R985. And they take a long time to warm up, particularly in the wintertime, as you will recall.
Yep.
And what you're looking for takeoff temperatures is 100 degrees on the cylinder head temperature, 40 degrees on the oil temperature. In the wintertime, that can take you 20 minutes or sometimes more to get up to those temperatures. So
okay.
If you have to be out of here, say, at 7:30 in the morning on the first flight of the day, you know, you want the airplane started maybe 10 minutes after 7, which, when you're working on the line crew, is what you do.
Right.
Which, as I recall, is one of the coolest things.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's great to start them. And there's probably as many different ways to start them as there are people starting them. There's some general guidelines, but there's no one absolute correct way. There's a few different things that work.
And everybody thinks their way is the right way.
Oh, of course.
So you'll taxi them, too. So this is actually, it's almost like continuing education.
You've got
your ratings and you're working the line, and unlike a lot of jobs, this job when you're working the line involves starting the planes and actually moving them around in the docks.
It does.
Valuable.
I always thought that the people who had worked here on the line crew made the best pilots, and I really still think that's true, because you can see it in their preparation, you can see it in their ability to handle the airplane around the dock. If you've had that background of working on the line crew, you're just better at that because of having more experience.
Right, that's a big part of flying floatplane.
Yep, that's in some sense part of the steepest learning curve is just docking, casting off from the dock, you know, dealing with obstacles around the docking environment. It's a real art.
So you finished the line job and you got hired as a flight instructor.
I did, and that was, I think it might have been spring of 93, just as you said, right about the time
we started.
You guys started on the line crew. And I worked 2 summers of instruction for Kenmore. Actually, you know what? I think I'm wrong on my dates. I think I instructed before that, because I think it was the spring of 93 that I started in the 135 operation.
That fits.
That makes more sense.
Yep.
So I was instructing probably by 91, I think.
I think you're right. We were about 92 or 3 that we showed up, probably 3.
Yeah.
And you were one of the head honchos.
Well, I wouldn't say that.
You were our boss.
But and look how far I've come.
So flight instructing, roughly 2 summers.
Yep, I did the flight instruction for 2 summers for Kenmore. At the time, we had 172s that we used. We had 3 of them. We went away from that airplane, and we now have Super Cubs. We have 2 Super Cubs. And I have not instructed in those, so I can't really compare them, but it's still the case that if your goal is to fly for the 135 operation and you have low time, low seaplane time, usually a summer or possibly 2 of instruction is what you need to get you there.
Okay.
And it's wonderful time because you get to see everybody else's mistakes and correct them. And it really helps you to be a better seaplane pilot.
Yeah, I bet. What prompted the switch from the 172s to Super Cubs?
The 172, I thought it was a great trainer because it's not exactly overpowered. You have to be really precise in the attitudes to get it to do what you want it to do. And as a teaching airplane, that's marvelous when you think about it.
Yeah.
Because somebody has to be really spot on the step attitude, for example. You know, to get the airplane to perform properly.
Right.
The downside of that is that if you are in any kind of adverse situation, the airplane doesn't have a lot of extra to give you. And we were just running into situations like that where it was concerning us. And the 172s were getting older.
Right.
And we just thought it was time to try something new. The Super Cubs, as I understand it, are great trainers.
Uh-huh.
I would say, just observing them, they have a lot more power and a lot more capability. So that's good and bad, I guess you could say.
You get sloppy and get away with it.
Sure.
But
you don't have to be as precise, but you have a lot of extra capability if you need it there.
Right. Well, and a lot of people who want to get into this, that's the type of plane they might actually buy.
It is.
And operate in.
Right. So that's a good thing about it.
And you do gain the cool factor.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
right.
That's undeniable.
Well, I have to say I missed the 172s, but that's just because I was so fond of this form. Sure. I was so familiar with them at the time.
When you're instructing in the summer, in the winter times, you were back on the line?
I instructed all through the wintertime.
Oh, excellent.
And I did some line crew work, too. And I remember my first winter, I didn't necessarily expect to be kept on. I thought perhaps I wouldn't be.
Right.
But there turned out to be enough instruction. Certainly not at the summer pace, but there were still people getting their ratings during the winter months. So there was enough of that to do. And then there was enough line crew work to do also. That carried me through that first winter. And once I made it through the first winter above the slow season, then I was able to stay on after that.
And we should point out that in Seattle here, the winter, it snows maybe a couple times a winter. So it's dark and rainy and cold out.
Right.
But it's generally not snowy.
Yeah.
And most nothing except a mountain lake would ice over.
That's right. And the wintertime weather here is generally flyable. The two things that shut us down are high winds and fog. Mm-hmm. And you get those sometimes, but not that often.
But do you find, is that trend consistent to this day, that if you get on as an instructor, you might not work that first winter, but the next winter you might, and can you make a living as an instructor? Sounds like you're kind of just scraping through the first year.
I would say at Kenmore, your financial life is better than it would be at a lot of places, by virtue of the fact that we've kept our instructors on salary, which is a pretty good deal.
That's huge, yep.
Yeah, it's so you're not dependent on flight hours like you would be at most places.
Right.
Yep. We've tried to get away from that.
That takes the pressure off to fly if the weather's not good.
Yes, it does, exactly. And for the instructors, it's enough to keep you going, definitely. What generally ends up happening is you make a pretty decent salary in the summer months when you're working a lot. In the wintertime, you just might go down to part-time.
Okay.
Certainly in your first season.
And I think I've seen in the past, you've had flight instructors also driving the delivery van.
Yeah.
I mean, you'll find works to keep to keep people busy so they keep making money.
Yeah, we have a parts department and we have a van that we drive around to deliver parts and pick up items that we need for the service department. And that's a great thing for a flight instructor to do to fill some time. I did it for a lot of years and liked it.
Yeah, so. That'd be it took a different way of, it's like driving, but you're driving a delivery van.
Kind of an interesting way to learn more of the business, really, and what's entailed in keeping the planes running.
Yeah, let's, we're kind of on this good track, and since you've been here so long and had such a good history here, now you're the chief pilot. When someone comes to you looking for a job, low time, they're probably looking for a flight instructing job, what are you looking for in someone who wants a flight instructing job? Do you only hire from the line guys, or do you do walk-in folks?
We have hired from outside the company. The best place for us to hire is from within.
Right.
Because then we know who we're working with. They have a proven track record. And anybody generally who's applying for an instruction job doesn't have a lot of flight time, usually, and probably even less seaplane time.
Right.
I think when I applied, I had, I'm going to guess, 50 to 70 hours total seaplane time, which isn't a lot. And we've worked with people that have less than that.
Okay.
The general things we look for is certainly somebody with some flight experience and somebody in terms of personality characteristics who's somewhat conservative. And, what you want to stay away from is somebody who, kind of views it more as an amusement park ride than as a real
job,
a real serious undertaking. I mean, float plane flying is just some of the most fascinating flying you can do, but it's pretty unforgiving because you've got if you have any issue with the water surface, you can have real problems. So, we try to look for somebody with, pretty high level of maturity and pretty high level of responsibility.
Okay. Are you are you in general, are you viewing someone that you hire as an instructor as someone that you're going to try to move up into
the schedule
flights? That's always kind of the plan.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you'd like to think if you hire somebody as an instructor that you can continue to work with that person in the years ahead. We kind of think of the instruction department as our farm team, if you want to put it that way.
Okay.
So once you've seen how somebody does as an instructor for a season or perhaps two, then you feel pretty good about moving that person up to the 135 operation.
Right.
And it's a huge advantage for us to have that farm team, if you want to put it that way. A lot of companies don't have that, and so the people they're working with, they haven't had a look at them at all, really, until they hire them for the 135.
Okay, cool. Let's continue with your career now. Done flight instructor, you moved into the charter / scheduled flights.
Right, in the 135 operation, and we have the fleet mix has changed a little bit in the 22 years I've been here, but not considerably. I know, can you believe that?
You still look young.
Yeah, well, thank you. We have a couple of 180s, and we have about 8 piston beavers, typically, at any given time. And we have 2 turbine beavers, and at the moment, 7 turbine otters.
7?
Wow. Yes, we just added a 7th this summer.
Wow.
And when I... When I started flying for the 135 operation in the spring of 93, the 180 was the first airplane I flew. That's how we used to do things back then. That was your first airplane. And I flew that. Sometime during that first summer, I got checked out in the beavers, the piston beavers. And that's what I flew for the first, I would say, 3 years of my 135 career here. And then eventually I got moved up to the turbine airplanes. First the turbine beaver, and then after that the otter.
How do you think the different airplanes, I mean, just a rough comparison between them. Obviously, the turbines are going to need more power. Do you have a preference in terms of which plane you like?
They all have their strengths. The turbine aircraft are, the main learning curve with those and the main difficulty with those is dealing with docking and cast off. They are very difficult initially to learn how to handle around the dock. Most of it has to do with the cast off and the long starting sequence that those airplanes have. In a piston airplane, when you're leaving the dock, you can hop in and start the engine right up and be on your way.
But you also have reverse in the turbine.
True. I've always said reverse in a turbine, it gets you into as much trouble as it gets you out of. There's no question about that. And I know this to be true from experience. But my favorite airplane, I really like the otters for their roominess. Uh-huh. You know, the cockpit for a small airplane is huge. You know, I've never flown an airliner, but it feels like one, or as close as I will ever get to one. So I like that. And so it's a very comfortable airplane. The downside of it is it's a little hard to handle around the dock because it is so big. Yep. And most of the places we go, we're doing this on our own. When the weather is poor and the visibility is not what you'd like it to be, I like the piston beavers because you can see out of them so well. They have excellent visibility. They're rock solid, stable at 80 miles an hour with the flaps down a little bit if you need to fly that way for a while. And they're just a good all-around airplane to have when the weather's
not so good.
Not what you'd want it to be. Yeah.
That's why they're the De Havilland Beaver.
Exactly. Yeah. That's why they are. It's the legend.
Yeah.
And you know, the 180s are wonderful on a day when the water's not too big and the visibility's pretty good. They all have their strengths. Mm-hmm. And just to round out a little comment about each one of them,
Turbine Beaver.
Thank you. The Turbine Beaver is like a sports car.
A rocket ship.
This very overpowered, very well-mannered machine that will just do anything that you ask of it. So, wonderful plane to fly.
That sounds fun. Do you, in terms of the breakdown, what flights do each plane get? Does the company try to send the otters on more of the scheduled flights to Victoria? The Turbine Beavers, I imagine, do more adventurous flights?
In general, the airplanes are fairly interchangeable. It depends more on the passenger load than it does on anything else.
Okay.
Although, that being said, the otters we tend to use to Victoria quite a bit because it's a one-stop destination. Mm-hmm. and we have the passenger count to justify using the otters. We tend to use both the otters and the turbine beavers, so the turbine equipment, the faster airplanes, we tend to use a little bit more for some of the longer trips. We are unique for a 135 float plane operation in terms of our scope. We go about 300 nautical miles is our range, north of here, north of Seattle, up to the north end of Vancouver Island.
So that would be a long distance.
Charter, though, right?
No, scheduled.
Scheduled, really?
Yeah, we do scheduled flights up to the Port Hardy and Port McNeil area, which is about 300 miles from here. Most float plane operators, to my knowledge, have a much smaller range, at least for their scheduled work, more like 50 miles, I would say, 50 to 70.
Okay.
And back to your question, so the turbine aircraft are really useful for the longer trips. Just
okay.
Because it's a long time to sit there in a piston beaver.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that'd be a long time.
Yeah.
It's like right. Old Harleys. So kind of we've gone on that a little bit, so let's sort of explore that idea a bit, the flights that you do with Kenmore. Like what's a standard run? You've got your Lake Union base as well in
we
Victoria.
Do.
What's the standard, a standard day? Like you show up for work on a normal summer day.
Mm-hmm.
What are you going to do?
A typical day, well, it's winter right now. Just let's talk about a winter day initially. We go to the San Juan Islands and to Victoria on the scheduled flights in the wintertime. And that's pretty much the extent of our work in the lean winter months.
Okay.
So a typical day, talk about mine today, I showed up here at 7 o'clock. Mm-hmm. And I had my departure out of the Kenmore base at 7:30 in an otter today. And I went down to Lake Union, that's our downtown terminal. And that's where just about everybody gets on. I'd say probably 90% of the people get on at Lake Union.
Okay, downtown to downtown.
Right. And then my trip today was up to the San Juan Islands. It was a little bit unusual in that I took a group up this morning and then I held all day up in the islands. It's much more common to turn right around, come back to Lake Union, and then do another round trip or two. Mm-hmm. So you'd have two or three round trips to either Victoria or the San Juans.
And okay.
In the San Juans, we have five different scheduled stops that we go to.
Okay.
So this time of year, you're pretty much done and wrapped up by about 4:30 in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. In the summertime, May through September, we go up to the Inside Passage of Canada. So we have a lot of destinations up there. We go to, I would say, probably 60 destinations all told in the summertime.
Uh-huh.
And the bulk of them are up in Canada. Mm-hmm. There's a bunch of destinations in the Canadian Gulf Islands, and then further up in Desolation Sound, Campbell River area. Most of these are fishing lodges.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's another group up in the Port Hardy, Port McNeil area. Mm-hmm. So your summer day, you might start out a little later. You might leave Kenmore at 9 o'clock, mm-hmm. in an otter full of people for the Campbell River zone. And typically you would not go through Lake Union. We tend to run those flights directly out of here.
Okay, people on vacation.
Yes.
For the most part.
Yep.
So, yep.
Yep. And you'd go to Nanaimo, clear customs, refuel, and continue on up to the Campbell River zone. You have a little bit of a layover up there, enough usually to have your lunch, and then you fly back down here. You might be done for the day, although in the height of the summer, it's much more typical that after that, you do a shorter trip back up to Victoria or back up to the San Juan Islands.
Okay. Sort of a technical question. When you're filing flight plans up there, you file ICAO flight plans into Canada, or do you file, you've got flight following through the company here?
We have flight following.
Combination?
It's a combination. We have flight following through the company. For the cross-border part of it, you have to be in a flight plan. You have to be in a discrete transponder code. So you don't have any choice about there. Once you're in Canada, flight following suffices. You don't have to file within Canada.
Okay.
You have to refile to get back across the border. And, of course, there's all the APIS requirements now. All the passenger information has to be sent and vetted the night before.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's a big deal. And that's true for departing the country, oddly enough. And it's true for getting back into the U.S. also.
Mm-hmm.
It's much more difficult than it used to be to do that. As a pilot, you don't notice most of that. Right. The flight plans are, at least the northbound flight plans are arranged for you. You don't even have to, you don't have to file it. You just have to activate it on the radio.
That's pretty nice.
And it is nice.
With the customs, do you have to stop somewhere to clear customs if you're going to somewhere more remote? Or
yes, you do.
Okay.
There are designated ports of entry in Canada. Our most common one is Nanaimo. And that's typically what we do, is stop at Nanaimo, clear customs, take on some fuel typically, and then continue on to the more remote spots. If we're going to the Canadian Gulf Islands, then Victoria is usually the scheduled custom stop. Also in the summer, there is the option of Bedwell Harbor. That's in the Canadian Gulf Islands. That's only open on a seasonal basis and only open for what they call CanPass flights. You know about the CanPass
system. Yeah, I know about the CanPass system.
Right. And that, so that's charters only. You can't utilize the CanPass system if you're on a scheduled flight.
Okay, CanPass always worked well for me.
It works great.
Yeah.
Yep, you just have to meet the basic requirements of it. You can have some long hold times on the phone, but that's the only drawback I've really encountered.
Yeah, so for people who don't know about it, CanPass, you just call up, say you're coming in. When you land, you just call an 800 number and tell them you're on the ground. They may meet you with some custom agents, but often you just call up, say, I'm here, everything's fine. They give you a CanPass number that, that's then your entry number.
Yeah, it's relatively rare they send out agents. They do sometimes, but usually not.
I've seen a couple, and if you're off on your estimated time of arrival, they get mad.
Yes.
They don't like that. For a part-timer, do you hire part-time pilots during the summer? Because your summer's your busy season.
Right.
So a part-timer, same schedule on a daily basis. In terms of the season, do they start in May? Do they start in June?
It depends. And to back up a little bit, we have about, on any given year, 10 to 12 full-time pilots that are here all year round.
That's pretty good.
And that number goes up to 40 to 45 pilots, a list of 40 to 45 that we draw from in the summertime.
Wow.
So that gives you an idea of how much the business spikes between May and September. And the part-time folks that we work with fall into a couple of different categories. There are the contract guys, we call them, and they're on monthly contracts. They might work May through September. They might work June through September. That's partly based on their availability, and it's partly based on what our needs are, the company's needs.
Right.
Or you might have somebody who works just July and August, because that's what they've got available, or perhaps that's, at that given year, that's all we really needed.
Right.
So there's that group of people. Then there are the part-time hourly pilots, we call them. These are guys that live in the Seattle area. They have a pretty good, in some cases, really good flow plane background. So these are not inexperienced people. They have to have a pretty good base of experience to be able to come in and pinch hit, if you will,
right,
and fly hourly for the company.
So a lot of those people did fly here full-time?
Some of them did, yes. Some of them flew full-time for us and then moved on to do other things, major airline work in some cases, or other things not connected with aviation.
Right.
Some of them have Alaskan operator experience.
Okay.
But most of them have thousands of hours of floatplane time, so they're the kind of people that you can call up and say, hey, we've got a couple of flights for you tomorrow to Victoria. Are you interested? And, in most cases, yes, they are.
Okay.
So it's a great way for them to get a little bit of floatplane flying in, and a great way for us to keep the schedule going.
So you keep them current.
Yes,
you,
we do.
They just, when they're needed, they live in town, and if they're not working their other job, they say, hey, I'm around for the next couple weeks, call me if you need anything.
Right.
Okay.
Right. What they do is they list their availability with us, and it's February right now as we speak, and we have the availability list out for this entire month. And somebody could, if they know in advance their availability for the whole month, they'll tell us. If they only know a week ahead of time, they'll tell us. Or they can tell us a day or two ahead of time.
Right, and you might have something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, so when we're filling out the schedule, when we're figuring out how to match up the pilots with the trips, which we usually do the night before, we'll schedule the full-time pilots, mm-hmm. of course. We do that first, and then we'll schedule the seasonal pilots, the ones that are on the monthly contracts.
Yeah.
And then if that fills all the holes, that's great. Normally it does not in the peak summer months. And so then we'll draw from the part-time available list. Mm-hmm. We'll look at who has made themselves available to round out the schedule.
Cool. But so a contractor, since a contractor's contracts differ, you can't say how much they're not relying on that for an actual living. It's usually they have time off of another job, and it's more like a seasonal job they enjoy doing, but they probably have other jobs as well.
Yeah, that's true. As I say, some of them are pilots for major airlines.
Yep.
Some are teachers. Some have other professions that they fall back to in the winter months. And when you do that and you work on a contract basis for the company, you can do pretty well. The monthly salaries are good. I mean, they're for that May through September range. The best monthly rate you could make for us would be if you worked just July and August.
Okay, it's the busiest month.
The two single busiest months that we have. So the rates tend to be higher for that. You know, almost as high for, it probably actually just as high for, say, June 15 through about September 15.
Okay.
And then as you get more towards the shoulder seasons on either side of that,
tapers off.
Then the average rate might go down a bit. But still, if you're working on a contract basis, that's a pretty good way to do it.
Pretty good way to supplement an income if you're a teacher or whatever other.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You can't beat it for a summer job.
Yeah, no kidding. It'd be great. I know it's years ago when I was a kid, when we first came back from Thailand, I think it was in 1980. We did a boat trip around the San Juans. I remember watching all the float planes coming in and out.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that looks like
fun. Yep. I was a sea kayaking guide in the San Juans. And
that's
saw
right.
You guys flying over thinking, that's what I want to do.
Yep. I think we all looked up and saw them flying around. Yeah.
I have a sort of technical question. All the flying you do, obviously, I know, is VFR.
Mm-hmm.
So two-part question. One, within that, are there any special waivers or anything that you guys have? I remember hearing of that years ago. And also, when you look for pilots, do you even care if they have instrument ratings?
The first part of the... Actually, let me take the second part of that first. They have to have instrument ratings. They're required to.
Okay.
That's part of... You can't... It used to be that you couldn't fly more than 20 miles away from... or 25 miles away from the place you took off from as a commercial pilot, unless you had an instrument rating. So, I'd have to look at the rule these days, but yeah, you're required to have an instrument rating. And in fact, on our yearly check rides, we do instrument recurrency. We don't shoot approaches because there aren't any approaches to the water that is around here, but we do just basic instrument currency. So that answers that part of it. As far as any special dispensation in the rules, we used to have for 30 some years, we had a altitude exemption that allowed us to go down to 200 feet for the 135 flights. It was limited to a geographical area, basically here, the Seattle area, north to the Canadian border, but that encompassed Victoria and it encompassed the San Juan Islands and everything in between, which is what we really needed. This past March of 2011, the FAA did not renew that exemption, and in fact, they have not been renewing anybody's exemptions in Southeast Alaska or anywhere else.
Wow.
They've essentially decided they're out of the business of renewing those, which is unfortunate. So now, in the absence of that exemption, it's back to 500 feet as the minimum. As the minimum altitude.
Make a big difference.
Well, it can make a big difference. If you're talking about a rain fog situation, most of the time it doesn't make a difference. There's nothing better at 200 feet than there would be at 500 feet. However, around here, we can get days where we can have a 400 or 500 foot hard ceiling with 20 miles of visibility underneath and good water conditions.
Yeah.
Those are the days when you'd really like to have that exemption.
Yeah, that's a... Someplace in Western Alaska I've been, you get a lot of that, a couple hundred foot ceiling,
right?
At 30 miles biz underneath.
Right.
It's frustrating.
It is. And it hasn't frankly had as much of an effect as I thought it might, because we flew all last summer with the 500 foot rule and that worked fine.
Yeah.
You know, there certainly were days and will be more days where you would like to have that exemption.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, I mean, it's just, it's the way it's going. I mean, it seems like the FAA is starting to not renew waivers. They've upped the PIC requirement, I think, from 135 by 1,500 hours.
Right.
That's a big change,
too. It is a big change, yes.
You know, it's going to hit a lot of the operators in Alaska, especially now with them, as the market's shifting a little bit to more of a a pilot market now, at least up there.
I think what was frustrating for us as far as the altitude exemption was concerned is that we could not and still have not ever gotten an answer from Washington, D.C. as far as why. And we've written letters and made phone calls, and it's unfortunate because, you know, they may have some reasonable positions as to why they want to do this, but it would be nice to hear them.
Yeah, and I suspect it's just they're not renewing waivers because then there's no
discussion needed.
Exactly, nobody gets mad at them.
Right.
Do you ever hire back to your sort of chief pilot status? So you'd like to hire pilots up from your flight instructor pool. Do you ever hire full-time, just straight-up scheduled 135 pilots just off the street?
If by full-time you mean full-time seasonal, yes, we do.
Okay.
For that May through September season, yes. And somebody you're looking for, if that person doesn't have a history with the company,
right,
what you're looking for, the gold standard, if you will, is previous 135 operator experience. There's nothing like it. There's nothing that takes the place of that. You can have a guy, for example, who has 1,000 hours of seaplane time accumulated in his own airplane.
Right.
And you could put him next to a guy who has 1,000 hours of seaplane time accumulated flying for an operator in Alaska or elsewhere. And the guy with the operator experience is the guy that you want to hire, typically, because he's the one who has done the kind of flying that our company does. And he's the one who has the more practical everyday experience that you're looking for.
And he knows
which
the
is
rev.
Not to say that the guy who's accumulated the time privately couldn't get to that point. Certainly, in most cases, he could.
Right.
It's just a little bit higher learning curve.
Do you like pilots from Southeast Alaska?
Oh, we love them. Yeah, I mean, my favorite group of pilots to work with are those that have Southeast Alaska experience.
Right.
No question. Yeah, they're great, almost to a person. They're just great to work with.
What's the main difference between being based down here and being based somewhere like Southeast Alaska? Some of the flying, I know, is very similar. When you do those long flights into BC, you're going to some fairly remote places.
Right.
But there's an advantage to being here, I would assume.
There are more differences to the flying. The clear advantage in terms of lifestyle is just living in the big city. You have all the amenities of a big city right here at your doorstep.
Yeah.
And, you know, anything really you could want is available to you. You know, unlike a smaller community, a more rural community.
You can go to the opera at night.
Sure.
Get a good cup. Of course, the people in Alaska who stay up there would tell you that's the downside.
right. Yeah, I think it really does all depend on what you're looking
on
for.
Your perspective.
If you want. I always thought it was fun living here and doing this kind of work because you live in a larger city with all its amenities, and you hop in your airplane and you leave all that for the day. Mm-hmm. And you go to remote areas and you see great scenery, mm-hmm. and then you come back to the comforts of the big city. So mm-hmm. it's a pretty neat arrangement. I think the hardest thing in terms of somebody coming from Southeast to the Seattle area, one of the harder things to adjust to, there's really two things I would point out. We have noise abatement issues. I know those are becoming more prominent mm-hmm. in Southeast, uh-huh. but they probably haven't risen to the level of what we deal with down here in the mm-hmm. Seattle area. There's pretty well-established noise abatement protocols for everywhere we go. And that takes a little bit of getting used to for people if they haven't dealt with that before.
Right.
And then the other thing is the boat traffic. There's a lot of boat traffic in Lake Union, Kenmore too, and even up in the San Juan Islands. So that can be...
Lake Union's really busy.
It is. That can be a pretty steep learning curve there as well.
But if you get a cool approach, though, coming in past the city, past the Space Needle, coming in to land.
Yeah, we usually come in that way to land to the north if... usually on the nice days, the wind's out of the north, so we come in over the city. It's a good approach.
Yeah, Victoria has a very sophisticated, complex series of regulations and traffic patterns. And
they do. They do. Victoria is a certified water aerodrome, and it has a pretty complex regulatory template put over it that that establishes runways and designates taxiways and really does a great job of separating vessels and airplanes. Mm-hmm. It's a great model. It's not a model you can take and apply directly to Lake Union, but it's good food for thought as far as what could happen down there.
When at Kenmore, too, you've also operated some other spots besides the Northwest.
We have. We tried our hand down at down in the Bahamas. We went down there in the late 90s. We put two otters on amphib floats and flew them down there. I flew one of them from Seattle down to the Bahamas, which was a lot of fun. and I spent parts of two winters. It was either two or three winters. Honestly, I can't recall if it was two or three. At least two, put it that way. And I flew for the company down there. We were based off the airport at NASA.
Okay.
And we typically just stayed within the family islands of the Bahamas and did day trips, kind of Kenmore in the Bahamas, if you want to put it that way.
Right.
We were home every night.
Tourists and vacationers.
Yes.
Yeah.
I did do one long 3-week charter that went down the entire island chain.
Wow.
All the way down. We ended up in Trinidad and Tobago. That was as far as we got. And then we turned around and came back up. Mm-hmm. Pretty much stopping everywhere you could stop along the way. So that was pretty neat.
That'd be fun. How did the flying in the Caribbean differ from the flying in the Northwest?
For me, the difference in the Caribbean flying was judging water depth. The water is so clear, and there are some real shallow areas in and around the Bahamas that that was a skill that I had to learn. You know, and it's not that hard to learn it. You know, dark blue is good. Light blue is probably okay. Tinging towards brown, not so good. Then you're talking about pretty shallow water at that point. But there are reefs in and among those areas. And at least down there is just no infrastructure. So you're dealing with beaches everywhere you go. Mm-hmm. Of course, since the airplanes were on amphib floats, we could operate off of the strips down there, off of the land strips, which was good. That was good to have that option if there were no other option, but lots of beachings.
How did you learn the ins and outs of that? Did you have a local pilots to work with, or did you guys just have to kind of figure it out as you went?
We did have a couple local people that helped us out, but a lot of it was simply going to a place and figuring out what worked.
Okay.
And that, you know, that was, you know, that's really what you have to do anyway, even if you've got somebody's best advice. You know, we were using otters, which nobody was using down there.
Right.
So we really had to go see a lot of it for ourselves and figure out what would work. In a way, it's kind of the same thing we do here if we have a charter request. You know, you vet it as best you can over the phone and looking at Google Maps and all the other resources you have, but there's nothing that substitutes for getting your eyes on it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yep.
For somebody who's thinking about becoming a floatplane pilot, what are some of the reasons why someone might choose float planes as the direction to at least start a career versus land planes?
Well, to me, it just all comes down to the flying itself and what we do. Mm-hmm. It's all daytime VFR stick and rudder flying to some of the most picturesque places you can go. And I have been at it 22 years, and it's just as interesting as it was when I first started doing it. And I have always enjoyed the evaluation process of it, meaning when you go someplace, you might have been there hundreds of times, or you might never have been there. But wherever it is, you have to figure out how are you going to get in and out of this place safely. What's the wind doing? Because after all, there's no windsock to tell you that, and there's nobody sitting in a tower to tell you that. You have to figure out what the wind's doing. You have to account for any obstacles, boats, logs, reefs, anything else. And you have to figure out what's the dock situation, if it's a beach, what's the beaching situation. So in other words, account for how you're going to get out before you even get in.
And tides.
Yep, right. Tides and currents. So there's all that. And if you like making decisions as a pilot, this is the kind of work you want to do. Mm-hmm. Because you get to make hundreds of them in a given day. Mm-hmm. And to me, that was always the interesting part about flying.
Right.
And I can't speak authoritatively at all to what commuter airline work is like or major airline work. I don't know. I haven't done it. But I can tell you that the airline guys we employ that do this just on a part-time basis, they often say, you know, I make more decisions here flying in a day than I do at my other job in at least a month.
Oh,
and that's what they tell me, and I have no reason to believe they're being facetious about that.
I was on Alaska Airlines flying out of Nome, and I was a passenger, and we had a compressor stall. We all in the back, we saw, you know, a huge ball of flying flame on the back of the engine twice. Mm-hmm. They didn't know what had happened. The crew thought that they might have had a baggage door open, but we circled for about 30 minutes while they called down to Seattle to find out what Seattle wanted them to do, and we ended up going and landing back in Nome.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, the pilots had to fly the plane.
Right.
And this was still in Alaska, but nonetheless, they are getting their direction for what to do
right.
from Seattle.
Right.
And I think that sums up what a lot of airline flying is like. They don't want the pilots making critical but not time-critical decisions on their own.
Right.
They want it to be a process where they talk to a mechanic or someone who's sitting on the ground making other decisions
right.
for them.
Yeah, and for this kind of work, there is just no one to talk to. You're out in the field, and you're on your own, which is really what I always liked about it. There's
yeah.
a very high degree of responsibility that you take with you every time you go, and that works for me. I like that.
How long since you've flown a land plane?
Well, you remember that amphib work we were talking about in the Bahamas.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that.
Quite honestly, I think that's probably the last time that I did, to be honest about it. That was back in the late 90s.
If somebody wanted to come work here, what's their best avenue to get a job?
The best avenue, first, is you have to be qualified on paper,
right.
meaning you have to have your commercial flow rating. And it's nice to have a CFI, although depending on how much total time you have, it's not absolutely necessary. And so that's the first thing. Beyond that, it really is just getting in touch with me or getting in touch with the company to let us know you're out there and let us know what you're interested in doing. And it's as much, I think it matters as much who you are as it does what your experience is. Experience, it really is important in this business. There's no real substitute for float time. But we are an operation that flies small airplanes, so you're going to have intimate contact with who you're flying.
Right.
And so we look for people who interact well with the public and enjoy working with the public. Because
right.
that's really a critical part of this. You know, because you're sitting elbow to elbow with your passengers.
Literally.
Yep,
yeah.
quite literally. So, yep, sure, you got to have the paper qualifications. It's nice to have some float time, but as I say, it also makes a big difference, you know, what your people skills are and how much you enjoy doing that.
So what I'm getting from that, a load time, someone would say 500 hours in a CFI, they should talk to you about a CFI job, but probably they're going to work a line job and work their way into a CFI job.
That's right.
If you've got a significant amount of float time, probably 1,000+ in, say, Southeast Alaska, you're probably going to start as a contract pilot for a summer job.
Absolutely.
That may lead into full-time work in the future, but it might take a season or two to do that.
That's well put.
Okay.
Yep.
Excellent. Anything you would like to add?
Not that I can think of. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Mike?
Yeah. Brought back some good memories.
Yeah, for sure.
Now we'll go try to move some planes around the port.
Yeah. Right.
Excellent. Well, thanks, John.
Yeah, thank you, guys. I enjoyed it.
We hope you liked this interview. If you found it useful, visit oddballpilot.com for more stuff like it.